the film with three brains. It's 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 the film with three brains.
Oh my god, you guys are freaks.
Welcome to the film with three brains. I'm Cohen in Maplewood, New Jersey.
This is Sean in Chicago.
And Sam in San Francisco.
The film we are discussing today is the 1981 Terry Gilliam film Time Bandits, starring a whole bunch of people you would recognize and a bunch more you wouldn't. But like I said, it was released in 1981. Terry Gilliam's really is his third feature film, only his second non Monty Python. The first one, he directed Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and then he did a film called Jabberwocky that nobody but me probably saw.
I've seen that.
And
I have not.
Oh, yeah. Oh, 2 out of 3.
Yeah.
It's not very good.
It's not very good.
Yeah. And then he did Time Bandits, which I think is very good. I've always liked this movie. I think it's great. It's weird, as all his movies are. If you're not familiar, listeners, with Terry Gilliam, he directed this. And then Brazil is probably what he's one of the more well-known movies, or what he's most known for, that 12 Monkeys, Adventures of Baron Munchausen, Fisher King, Very Lonely in Las Vegas, a bunch more. Anyway, so Time Bandits, strange, pretty weird. I'll give a quick plot synopsis. 6 dwarfs who work for the Supreme Being steal a map to all the holes in the universe that they were hired or enlisted to fix. And their only goal is to get rich. So they use the map to bounce around through time, stealing shit from people and then escaping. And none of it ever really works out. And it sort of culminates in a showdown with evil, the personification of evil, played by David Warner, over the most fabulous object in the world. And yeah. It's weird. And it's got a pretty interesting cast. Other than dwarves, you know, I think Kenny Baker is probably the only one anyone might know. Sam, you probably know.
Of course, R2-D2.
Yeah. Right.
He's the star.
Yeah. This is also, so if listeners, you recall when we discussed The Warriors, Time Bandits is another movie my uncle had taped onto a VHS tape when I was a little kid. And I saw several times as a result, so it has a special place in my heart because of that. But also, it's pretty good. What do you guys think? What are your thoughts? Go.
Sean first.
Thoughts. Yeah, you know what, I think I definitely like this movie, and I know it pops into my head now and again. What I forgot watching this time was the little scenes with Shelley Duvall and
and Michael Palin.
Yeah. Which is pretty funny. I guess there's only a couple of them, but it was enough to be noticeable. I'm like, oh, that's fun.
it's the two main ones. The one in the sort of the Middle Ages, the Robin Hood bits. And then again, when they're on the Titanic. Yeah. When I was a kid, in those scenes I found totally befuddling. Because they talk about basically, you know, erectile dysfunction and whatever else. I mean, even now watching, I'm like, that's the way it's written is really strange.
Yeah.
Which adds to its charm. It's funny.
That's the Monty Python coming out, I think.
Sort of the absurdist humor.
Yeah, this is somewhere between a Monty Python and a real movie, in my opinion. It's because like 12 Monkeys is a real movie. There's nothing Monty Python about it. But I have to think, I have to. So this is the first time I've watched this movie since the 1980s. I don't remember.
Oh, yeah.
It was like watching it for the first time. There was so little that I remembered from the actual movie. And there are parts. The way it's produced, I think this is one of the last movies that looks like it was made in maybe the 60s. Like it has the soundtrack and the loud like clashing, these harsh noises that are a lot like the Ten Commandments or Spartacus or even Planet of the Apes. Yeah. It's just it has that feel, the color of the way it's shot. Mm-hmm. And it's part of it's like they just raided the warehouse at the film studio. So they're like, well, you know, what do we have from these other movies they made in the 60s and 70s? And like, oh, well, we're clearly going to go see Napoleon. We're clearly going to go back to, you know, ancient Greece, you know, or Roman times, which he couldn't really tell because nobody spoke a foreign language. It's nice that they all spoke English. Yes. So to me, it was like watching this for the first time. There are elements of it that I realized, there's some really clever things in here, and there are other things that I was just boring. Like, it's weird to watch a main character get dragged through a movie. They just don't do that very often. And, you know, he was very much, but when you realize that Terry Gilliam wanted to shoot a movie from a kid's point of view, like, a little kid is dragged through the day all the time. So it's like, if that was his goal, like, it kind of makes sense. You know, he was ignored repeatedly, you know, and I think a lot of little kids are, you know, so it's to me, it's like, well, maybe that's just part of it. I enjoyed it. It was fun to see it again, but I wouldn't say it's great filmmaking, but it's amusing.
It's certainly not polished. You know, it's pretty raw.
Yeah.
It was only, I think I read it, its budget was around $5 million.
Oh, wow.
Made something like 40. So it was a pretty big success. For the time, you know. I mean, it is very rough around the edges. And I noticed, I haven't seen it in a few years, and I haven't seen it, geez, I don't know, since I've been editing as much as I do at my job. I'm a commercial editor, listeners. And, you know, as an editor, you tend to notice certain things, you know, continuity errors and things like that. And this one has quite a few, but it's nothing anyone would really probably notice. For the most part. But yeah, the color's a little washed out and everything's a little clunky. You know, the cuts are a little clunky, but I definitely find it charming. The cast is pretty interesting. Sean Connery's in it. Totally weird. you know, John Cleese, Michael Palin, from Monty Python, Shelley Duvall, Katherine Hellman, from Soap, and a bunch of other stuff. Also,
Ian Holm is Napoleon.
Ian Holm is Napoleon, right? Like I said, Dave Warner is evil. The Supreme Being is played by someone whose name I can't seem to summon right now. Yeah. Anyway, there's a lot of like visually clever things going on. You know, that you'd expect from Terry Gilliam, but you know, we now might expect from, or at least up until his last few movies, which have been kind of terrible for a while. He's on kind of been on a streak. Since Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. I think trying to make The Man Who Killed Don Quixote sort of broke him. A movie he could just never get made. Yeah. It's a super tiny detail, but for some reason, when the portals open for their little time traveling jaunts, for some reason, I don't know why, but it kind of tickles me. I really love the way it looks. It's a stupid, simple little effect. And every time, when the movie, and it goes, boom, makes a noise, I'm like, ha.
They're really creative with that, though. I mean, starting with the bedroom, the wall that pushes out.
Yeah, yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah, it just keeps going and going and going.
And the magic trick with Agamemnon and the.
Mm-hmm.
They use it in fun ways.
Mm-hmm.
So just to go off here, Ralph Richardson is the Supreme Being.
Oh. I don't even recognize the name, actually.
He's a ton sure of movies in the 1980s all the way back to the 1930s. And when he was a caterpillar in Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, if that helps for you. He was the Crypt Keeper in Tales from the Crypt, the 1972 version. He's in a bunch of stuff that I've never even heard of. But he was in the Greystoke, the Legend of Tarzan. He was the sixth Earl of Greystoke, which is the only movie of his that I've seen on this list that I know for sure. I mean, he was the voice of a rabbit in Watership Down, which I know I've seen too. Oh, and he was in Rollerball, which I think we referenced once or maybe not.
The original? Oh, that's right. He plays the big bad, like, head of the corporation who totally screws over James Caan.
And then your other thing that you mentioned was, why in the world is Sean Connery involved in this?
Yes.
So apparently Sean Connery played golf with Dennis O'Brien, who was one of the producers, I think. A friend. So, played golf with him. And anyway, he's told him about it. And Sean Connery was a fan of the Monty Python movies. So he said he was interested. So that's how it got in. Hmm. And then, O'Brien was one of the people who funded the movie with George Harrison. It was one of those things at the end when I'm like, what's a George Harrison song, dude? And I mean, obviously I know the British connection, but then I was looking at it, I was like, oh, he actually was one of the producer. And it was George Harrison actually mortgaged a building to finance the film. They couldn't get funding because the studios didn't think it would be a commercial success.
Yeah.
So they did it themselves. Anyway, those are my little facts. I'll have more later.
getting the film made, being such a huge obstacle, I think, obviously from an early standpoint, this being Terry Gilliam's only second or third feature film, it just kind of haunted him the rest of his career. Not that he's dead or anything, but it seems like you just hear and read stories about this poor guy who just can't get his movies off the ground, even though he's made some really good films. He just has no luck. One other person who's in Time Madness is Jim Broadbent. Has a small role as the game show host.
What was that game show called? Your Money or Your Life?
Yeah, Your Money. Is that what it's called? Your Money or Your Life? I think it was.
I think so.
<You're right. laughs> Silly. So the synopsis I gave was pretty brief. I just wanted to maybe get into a little detail because I think the story is kind of interesting and they don't really pay off a lot of it. Like there's a lot unspoken in this movie. Plot wise, there's a lot, they just let all kinds of shit slide, which is fine. So there's six dwarves who magically appear in this kid's room in England, and they're dressed pretty weirdly. One looks like a pirate, one looks like a sailor, one's wearing like a colander on his head and has a netting, around him. Anyway, and they're running from someone. They don't know who, or we don't know who yet, but turns out they're so. The way he explains it to Kevin, the little boy, Randall's the leader of the dwarves, is that the universe was only made in 7 days. And it was kind of a botched job. So they have a lot to fix. And they have a map of all the things that need fixing, which are holes, like in the fabric of time. And so they're supposed to be fixing all these holes. And instead, they steal the map. And then they decide to become international thieves. And, at the point where they run into the kid, they haven't stolen anything from anyone yet. Their first real... theft is from Napoleon, who's losing when they arrive. Everything's going downhill for him. He's done. And so they steal a bunch of his stuff and disappear into their portals. Later, they end up, I don't know what time period you would consider the Sean Connery scenes. He's supposed to be Agamemnon from ancient Greece. Anyway, they get separated. Two portals open and Kevin jumps into one and the dwarves jump in the other. And he ends up there alone and Agamemnon basically adopts him. Very rapidly and says, this will all be yours. And then the dwarves show up and they take them back and they end up, going after the most fabulous object in the world in the time of legend. And that's, for me, that's when it gets pretty interesting is when they go to the time of legend.
Yeah.
That's when it starts to get pretty weird with the giant in the water. They're on a boat and he wears like a hat, stuff like that. Anyway, turns out evil is a man who's been confined, and he's trying to escape and he needs the map to do it. So he lures them there to steal the map. Eventually he is defeated, but mostly just because the Supreme Being shows up and is like, all right, see you. You're done. And that's it. And that's the movie.
Are we going to talk about spoilers? Because
yeah, sure.
Pretty big one at the end.
Yeah.
It's what stuck with me probably most about this movie. Which is weird.
Which part?
The very end.
Like when he
like
finds
the parents.
Don't touch it.
Yeah. The piece of evil. It's evil. Don't touch it.
I mean, I guess it's set up by him. Yeah, being ignored, not really liking his parents, not wanting to go back. He keeps saying that, but
yeah.
But he has a big part to play, and I think the Supreme Being says something like he has to keep fighting or something, in the end. Which I don't remember that before, but
so I think you can give away the spoiler and say what happened.
Yeah. So it's after all they're obsessed with all these appliances and she is like, yeah, why didn't you go back for the blender? And then the fire brigade is like, well, this, you left your roast in the in the oven or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, they both touch it and then it's vaporized, explode. So we're back in the real world. I mean, I guess we're supposed to know it's all kind of real. I mean, we're
ends up looking in his shoulder bag and he sees all the Polaroids he's been taking throughout the whole movie. They're all still there.
Right.
And then Sean Connery shows up as a fireman, which I don't know. What are we to read into that? Or is it just like a goofy little thing?
Was Sean Connery's idea. He just thought it'd be cool to put himself in at the end. There's no real explanation as to why. He just thought it would be a good idea.
There's a couple.
He gets another heroic part.
I think but it also shows like, you know, that things come around again, you know, I think, but the not touching when he yells, you know, don't touch it, it's evil. It's just one more example of him being ignored as a kid. Yeah. And the, Terry, the producer, O'Brien has said it, that, said, no, we can't have that in the movie. There's no way we can have the kid's parents die. And Terry Gilliam's like, no, kids will get it. They'll be fine with it. Like they'll be okay. It's the parents that'll be upset, but this movie isn't for the parents. And he eventually won out that he was so stubborn that he needed to have that happen. And there's like, this is one of those movies that you're like, at first glance, you're like, oh, it's just a kid's movie, but there's some deeper stuff in here that you're like, when you talk about religion, you know, Kevin, as the supreme being, like if this was all just a plan, a plot to get at the evil one and stop him, why did you let all those people die? And, you know, the supreme being just shrugs it off. He's like, I think it has something to do with free will. But it's like the same question people ask of religion all the time. Like if God really exists, why do horrible things happen?
Yeah.
And, you know, so it's to me, I think there's some deeper things here that nobody talks about. I'm sure there's probably some website or book out there, but I it was those little bits in there that I think make the movie worth watching again as an adult, because as a kid, you'd never even think twice about all these little things that happen that actually have deeper meaning.
Yeah.
And glad he did fight for it, because without that scene, everything is just a little too perfect. You know, it's not very Terry Gilliam. It's like, even the dead dwarves are fine. That, you know, I'll stop being a pig.
Right.
Yeah. So it's tidy, but you know, Terry Gilliam doesn't usually do tidy.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing too is he has a picture of the map.
Yeah.
At the end, you know, they don't say, but he does, you know, it's like, and he's totally free. Like he has no parents. He has a picture of the map and he just saw Agamemnon again in the future. Like to me, it's just like, okay, go on for more adventures.
Right. You know? Yeah.
Yeah, maybe he'll check in on him as part of his duties or something. I don't know. I mean, it's still very like stark when everyone leaves and he's walking around still saying their names, and then pulls back through the entire universe or solar system anyway.
Right, and then you see the map again that gets rolled up and stuffed away, kind of like the end of Men in Black or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was going to say before when you said it was Sean Connery's idea, just it'd be kind of funny. There's one other thing that always, I don't know, I wouldn't say it bothered me, but I've always wondered about is when they're the whole sort of third act where they're kind of fighting with the evil one, evil, you know, the evil guy, and they're in his, you know, Fortress of Darkness, whatever they call it.
And I think he just calls himself evil, right?
Yeah. Evil. And, it's like there's all these life-size versions of the toys that you would find in a kid's bedroom.
Yeah.
You know,
like giant Legos.
Yeah, giant Legos. And there's
from his bedroom.
Yeah, exactly. And there's the cowboys that just magically show up on horses and lasso the guy. And then there's, you know, the astronaut, like the space shuttle toy or thing. And then with lasers shooting out of it and everything. And I, you know, when I was a kid and I saw it, I thought, well, what does that mean? Is it all in his head? Is it just a dream? I don't know. And then, you know, and then he has the pictures in his thing at the end, and there's Sean Connery. And so I always wondered if Terry Gilliam had any any intention of any of that, or if it's just sort of red herrings and misdirection just to be, you know, just to be goofy.
Mm-hmm. There's some subtler things there. If you notice that at the beginning of the movie, the parents were sitting on the couch, and the couch is coated in thick plastic, like some people used to do.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the bad guys who are the henchmen for evil are also wearing that same clear plastic as part of their outfits.
Yeah.
And evil, you know, talks about how great technology would be he wouldn't create a slug or parrots or whatever. He would create a laser. And so I think that there's also this, you know, subtle or maybe not so subtle anti-technology bend to it that you know, God's pure and technology's evil that shows up. And kind of the way we live in a modern day is evil, which is way too deep for Time Bandits. But it seems like it's in there.
Well, evil has this little speech where he says, I want to understand microchips. And once I understand microchips, you know, I'll understand this. I'll understand this. And once I understand this, and I'll understand computers. And once I understand computers, I will be the supreme being, you know, lending a lot of weight to his faith in technology, even though he is basically a godlike creature already. You know, he zips, you know, he just like points at someone, guy explodes, turns, you know, one of the dwarves into a pig, turns one of the guys into a dog.
Benson.
But he thinks computers are going to, you know, make him the supreme being.
Very strange.
I like how excited they are to finally die.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Oh, thank you.
Right.
Yeah, there's humor throughout the whole thing, but there's like the cages, when they escape the cages. Mm-hmm. I remember that when I was a kid and I mean, it's just a big soundstage, or I don't even know how they filmed that, but it was cool. Yeah, it was cool. Like, it showed how well they work together and how brave they are.
That was always my favorite scene in the whole movie. I love the scene where they escape from the hanging cage.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did too. That was one of the only ones I remember.
Yeah. And you know, saw off little pieces of the rope and, you know, make their own rope. And then the way they seesaw swing themselves across. And then Wally at the end goes, watch this. And he drops and he almost falls. And I always thought it was really well shot, like well produced. You know, there was some of the other stuff looks a little hokey, a little low budget. Some of the miniatures and models and stuff don't look so great. But that scene to me always looked really good. And
for
then
some reason, I thought of House with the skeleton bird and the shotgun.
Yeah That's right.
It's all black and
I vaguely remember that too. To put that on the list.
I have it on Blu-ray. So Terry, getting back to Terry Gilliam for a minute, you know, our previous film we talked about was City Lost Children, which is sort of surreal and odd, and Terry Gilliam sort of fits in that mold. After this, you know, he probably garnered enough goodwill and had a good enough, you know, box office on Time Bandits. He was able to make Brazil, which is even weirder, I think, right?
Which is exactly what happened. He actually had Brazil's script done before this, and he couldn't get anyone to make it. So he's like, okay, I'm going to make a movie that for kids, and someone will produce it. And even though he still had to work his butt off to get it done, that was what he did, and that's exactly what happened. He did Brazil after it,
right? And then after that, he did the Adventures of Baron Munchausen, which has its moments, but it's pretty weird. Certainly, his most expensive looking film at that point. But I forget what he calls it. He calls these Time Bandits, Brazil, and Adventures of Baron Munchausen sort of a spiritual trilogy of sorts, where Time Bandits is about, you know, from a kid's point of view. Brazil is from a middle-aged man's point of view, and Baron Munchausen is from an elderly man's point of view, which I always thought was kind of interesting. And then after Baron Munchausen, he has his first real, I would say, like, big commercial success, which is The Fisher King, which was very popular, as I recall. Am I misremembering that?
No, I think Robin Williams was nominated for an Academy Award. I can't remember if that's true, but I'm pretty sure it is. I'll find out in a moment.
So Yeah, Robin Williams and Jeff Bridges.
Jeff Bridges, yeah. I'm looking at Wikipedia. It says it's the Trilogy of Imagination.
Ah.
And then it says, all are about the craziness of our awkwardly ordered society and desire to escape it through whatever means possible.
Hmm.
But I had never thought about that. The child, it's like the Sphinx riddle or something.
Yeah, yeah, the riddle of Sphinx.
Fisher King was nominated for best actor, and he did not win.
But Mercedes Rule won for supporting actress. And then it was also nominated for original screenplay, art direction, and score. And of course, it also was nominated and won a bunch of other awards, like BAFTA, Golden Globes, stuff like that. It won a bunch of stuff in the film festival circuit, too. And then 12 Monkeys, so he seemed to be sort of, working his way up. 12 Monkeys had Brad Pitt and Bruce Willis.
Yep. Madeline Stowe.
And Madeline Stowe, right. And that was also a pretty big success, as I recall. I mean, I like it. Mm-hmm. Is that any gauge? I don't know. Something after that, though, man. What happened after that? I mean, he did Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which I like. Probably not quite as well received, but still, interesting movie and good cast. Then he did The Brothers Grimm.
Oh, yeah. Oof. That was weird. I don't think I finished that.
I know I saw it. I don't remember. I just remember how much I hated it.
Yeah, it wasn't a good movie.
What's that? I think it was Matt Damon and Heath Ledger.
Was Matt Damon doing an accent in that movie?
I think he was. Yeah. Shit. Yeah, I think he's trying.
Sure, you can kind of do one, but.
And then Tideland, which I never saw. I don't know anything about it. But then The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, which is most known for being Heath Ledger's, what he was working on when he died. Mm-hmm. And instead of just recasting him, Terry Gilliam actually used a whole slew of successful male actors in a similar age range to replace him and sort of wrote it into the script where the character is going through an evolution, Johnny Depp and... Colin Farrell. I don't remember who else ended up playing that character as he, changed him. And then The Zero Theorem, which I don't know anything about either. I don't know. I don't know what happened to him. He just sort of he was on a pretty fast moving trajectory up and then it just sort of dropped off. I don't know.
So some questions.
Yeah.
Suitable for kids?
Sure. Mm,
totally. Worth going back and watching?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Should it be remade?
Well, that's an interesting question because I did not know this until today. I was reading something about it. And apparently, as of last year, Apple TV's streaming service was preparing to create a series out of it. They bought the rights.
Yep.
And what's his name? Tiki Wai. I can't ever say his name. The New Zealand guy who directed Thor Ragnarok.
Mm-hmm.
Was supposedly directing the pilot or something. But that's the first I've heard of it. And I haven't heard anything else about it either. But I think, like you said, Sam, at the end, the kid, he has a picture of the map and his little magnifying glass, which they used once before. I mean, I'm sure that's not where they're going to go with the series, but it makes sense. They could have made more movies.
Well, I mean, this is you could make a million different trips through the past and steal a bunch of different things and all that. Which has been done, I think, in other ways, some sort of time cop Stargate sort of thing this is room. I think, it's probably not fair to say, but to me, I think it's hard to have a bunch of the dwarves as heroes because they're just not convincing in a fight. Totally not politically correct, but it's just...
I mean, it's true, though.
When some of the people are giants and they're not.
Well, I think, one could probably argue that when it comes to the movie, they never do really try to anyway. It's more about subterfuge, misdirection.
Oh, yeah, they rely on their wits.
Yeah, yeah. Which, I mean, they're not terribly smart. They're vaguely capable. I was thinking about they speak of a character who died before, within the context of the movie, died before the story begins. named Horseflesh, who was, you know, their apparent leader. They never talk about how he died, what happened. Like we were saying earlier, there's a lot in this movie in the plot that doesn't get explored. You know, it just kind of makes innuendos and touches on certain things. I think there's a lot of sort of rich material there they could mine. I'd be interested in seeing a TV series. I hope they do it.
I would think the danger of doing a series of it would be ending up with Quantum Leap.
Yeah.
You know,
Quantum Leap with dwarves.
With dwarves.
I mean, and speaking of dwarves, you know, there's six of them, and the dead character Horseflesh would have made seven. I don't know. I guess that makes Kevin Snow White. You know, I don't know. I'm sure there was some sort of some underlying thought going into that when they were writing it, when Terry Gilliam and the I forgot what the other guy's name is were writing it.
That has been mentioned elsewhere, but not. I couldn't find that it was actually confirmed.
Yeah.
And I think the dwarves are supposed to, like, essentially they're just more kids.
Yeah.
You know, that they're not playing the role of, you know, adults. They're playing kids. They do ignore him though, when like adults did, but they also listen to him like adults didn't.
Yeah. Well, they're the only ones in this movie who really listen to him, you know?
Yeah.
And they even, and they say early on, you know, the one guy, I forgot his name, says to Randall, he says, you know, he's really smart. He knows a lot.
Yeah.
And he's bigger than all of us. So, yeah, I think there's an interesting dynamic there where, you know, if they were to, you know, continue the series with the same characters where, you know, Randall's the character who thinks he's the leader and Kevin is the one who is. Which I think is an interesting dynamic.
This probably doesn't need to explain. Oh, sorry. Go.
No, that was it.
The whole Quantum Leap thing, I mentioned that because obviously it could have some cheesy music or something. But I mean, part of what I like about it is how fast it moves from place to place.
Yeah.
And how it doesn't always, like you said, they're not successful robbers. They're just, you know, they're kind of misguided, finding their way. And then it turns into something bigger, you know, toward the end.
Right.
But I wouldn't, you know, with a series, I think it would be more, they would spend an entire episode on the beginning just to get to the time bandits showing up.
Yeah.
That would be my guess. But hell, I'll watch it. I mean, I don't have Apple Plus, but.
I do.
Did you watch that M. Night Shyamalan thing?
Not yet. No. Okay. The only thing we've been watching is the morning show, which I like a lot. I thought it looked stupid in their promos, but it turns out it's pretty interesting. They got me, Apple.
They don't have a lot of shows out yet, do they?
No, not really. Mostly, you know, a couple of original things, but yeah, the M. Night one, Servant. I think the first episode's available. I haven't watched it yet, though.
All right. Well, that concludes our product placement portion of the show.
Well, we should say where we watched this movie as well.
I got a copy from the library. I couldn't find it online without paying for it.
Yeah. I just threw my Blu-ray disc of it in and watched it.
It was not on Amazon Prime unless you did Cinemax, so I did Google Play.
Mm-hmm.
$2.99.
So we talked, I think you mentioned the budget that it was $5 million to make this movie.
Yeah.
And it, you know what it did at the box office?
I think about 40.
Yeah, 40, 42.
Yeah.
And do you know what was the next one? Not Brazil. The next one that he did.
Baron Munchausen.
Yeah. Do you know how that did?
Oh no idea. I'd imagine it probably wasn't a big success.
Yeah.
No, it was a huge loss. It was made for about $40 million, and it made about $8 million. So it was pretty much the opposite of.
Oopsie.
Yeah. So that's why he's had some difficulty making movies.
Yeah.
12 Monkeys made $168 million, so that made up for it.
And they made a series out of that eventually too on the Sci-Fi Network, I think.
And then, just because I have to point her out, you know who Miss Ogre was, correct?
Oh yes. Yeah, that was Catherine Hellman.
Yeah, who for me will always be Mona from. Who's the
boss? Mona?
Oh yeah. I for some reason I think of her as the woman from Soap.
Yeah, I mean,
I know that, but I never really watched soap. I mean, I remember watching a couple episodes. I mean, that was a long time ago. We were pretty young when that came out. But also then, and you know, the woman who get her face stretched in Brazil, but then as I always think of her too as Goldie Hawn's mother in Overboard.
Overboard.
Yep. I didn't remember that she was in it. So when I saw her, I was like, oh, it's Mona. Like I wouldn't have even known her real name unless I looked it
Mona.
Up.
And she had to get into a water tank. It's a lot of mud and water. You know, like there's a lot of sloppiness in for the actors.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a dirty movie.
Probably wasn't altogether pleasant to shoot.
No, they said that it was 130 degrees in Morocco when they were filming. So Sean Connery made him film all their parts earliest in the day so he could leave.
So I wonder, this must be 1981 must be just after he stopped playing James Bond, right?
Yep.
Right.
Pretty close.
Roger Moore days by then.
Yeah. Right.
Huh. Yeah. What was he doing? Was Russia House around then? I don't know.
He was still at the height of his career. I mean, that's, you know, he'd done a bunch of the James Bond movies, but then, you know, he was in Never Say Never Again, which was 1983. So that
I don't think that's considered canon for Bond movies.
Because
it was a different, it was like a different production company or something. It wasn't blessed by the, you know, it wasn't Albert R. Broccoli or what the hell his name is. And it was basically a remake of Thunderball. All very strange. It was weird.
He went on to do The Name of the Rose, which he got acclaim for.
Yeah.
And then The Untouchables.
Well, The Untouchables was huge.
Which is great.
Yeah.
He got an Academy Award for that one. He did Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade, obviously.
Right.
Never stop quoting that, at least for me.
Yeah.
Indiana was the dog's name. Hunt for October, obviously, was great.
Yeah. And then the Russia House, Sean.
Yeah.
Nice. I don't know where that came from.
Sean's favorite, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Plays the king again.
Yeah, he got to be a dragon in Dragonheart.
You guys are completely skipping over The Rock.
Come on. Yeah, I was just gonna say I knew if I skipped it, you'd call it.
And I'd like to point out that The Rock has the single stupidest pun in the fucking world when Sean Connery goes, "Well, it looks like you're between The Rock and a hard case." Oh God. I'm like I feel like I get kicked in the stomach every time I hear that terrible line.
How often do you hear it?
In my nightmares every night. I don't know. I mean, I've seen The Rock, I don't know, a bunch of times. It's pretty good.
I've only seen it once.
What?
Yeah, I've only seen it once.
How long ago?
Right back when it came out. It does fall on our list. It's 1990. 90, so.
Yeah, 96. The Rock was one of my very few trifectas, one of my hat tricks. There aren't too many of those where I saw three movies in the same day. It was The Rock, Eraser, and I think The Cable Guy. Is that sound right? 96.
What a day.
Yeah. So right. We're so talking about Time Thailand. Bandits. No, I haven't seen Tideland.
Yeah, we aren't.
What the hell is Tideland? I know I've heard of it. I don't know what it is, though.
It's Jeff Bridges, and it's about grief and moving into some big house in the middle of nowhere. I have not made it through that movie either. I didn't make it through Imaginarium Dr. Parnassus. I didn't make it through that one. I didn't make it through all those ones we were talking about.
Yeah.
The ones that didn't hit. So, yeah.
Yeah. And then the Zero Theorem.
What's that?
I think I tried to watch that at some point. It's with Christoph Waltz. I don't know. I think it's all very metaphysical and weird, just allegorical and strange. I don't know. Just guessing from the synopsis. A hugely talented but socially isolated computer operator is tasked by management, with a capital M, to prove the zero theorem that the universe ends as nothing, rendering life meaningless but meaning is what he already craves. Oof. Yikes.
Oh, Sean Connery's name was Thomas? I didn't know that.
No, I did not either.
Thomas Sean Connery, named after his grandfather.
Hmm.
Apparently, I was named after him, so now I feel shortchanged. I was given a middle name.
Are you serious?
Darn it.
That's what my mom really says, but it's only come up a couple of times. And with my mom, sometimes I don't know that she's not embellishing so much that it's just completely fabrication. She's like, oh, yeah, Sean Connery.
Just feeding your ego. You're a special boy. Your dad's Sean Connery. I named you after him. One night stand. All right. Have we killed this movie?
Yeah, I guess so.
What are we watching next?
Ooh, what are we watching next? Whose pick is it?
Is it me?
Sean's.
Oh.
Snuck up on you.
Does that mean it's going to be a secret?
I can do the one that I mentioned earlier because I think it'll be another departure from what we've been doing. And it is our first sports movie. It's not that much of sport. I mean, it is and it isn't. It's called Fever Pitch, but not the one with Drew Barrymore and the damn Boston Red Sox. It's the one that came first. So the pitch actually refers to a soccer pitch or
right.
Oh, pitch. It's Colin Firth. That's the
yeah, it is.
On the that was the late 90s.
It's a romantic comedy and it's based on a Nick Hornby book. So
right.
Yeah,
I went back and read the book and that was fun.
That was the follow up to Nick Hornby's other book, which was about a boy, right?
Right.
Yeah, I think I saw Fever Pitch. Let's see, who was.
Or was it the other way around?
Yeah, about a boy. Fever Pitch was kind of not known very well. Nobody really knew what it was. And I just came across it, I think, from one of your friends.
About a Boy is after it.
The
book
or
the movie or both?
The movie. And that one was pretty successful.
I'm pretty sure I've never seen Fever Pitch.
Yeah.
Awesome.
I think it's, I don't know how good it's going to be. It's, I've only seen it once, which is kind of a big risk, but what the hell?
Yeah, why not?
Hey, I'm psyched. If we're watching a movie, Cohen hasn't seen that. Yep. That alone is worth it.
You guys have both picked one now. I haven't seen. Oh, wait. No, I had seen Thief. Is this the first one I haven't seen?
I thought I picked a movie.
I thought you did. What would that have been?
Oh, because I made you watch Babe.
Oh, yeah. I'd never seen Babe. That's right.
Yeah, but now you've seen it probably 20 times since then because you love it.
That's right. It's my favorite movie.
It is one of the best movies. And as far as reviews went, it was good until now. This is clearly our best review.
We've stepped up our game once again.
Yep. Definitely. But I have a feeling Fever Pitch is going to be pretty good, too.
Yeah, we'll see what we can pull off.
Yeah.
All right. This has been the Film with Three Brains.
Thanks for listening.
Bye. It's the Film with Three Brains.